Hello and welcome to The Canon, the show where every single week we get together and argue, debate, and sometimes even amicably agree about whether certain movies belong in the canon of all-time greats to live on forever in immortality. My name is Devin Faraci of Birth, Movies, Death, and joining me as always
is Amy Nicholson of the LA Weekly.
Amy, before we get to this week's movie, All About Eve, we should talk about last week's movie, Tulane Blacktop. We had Noah Segan in, noted character actor Noah Segan.
Tremendous hair, Noah Segan.
And he and I were on the side of Tulane Blacktop. You were against it. What did the listeners have to say?
The listeners were very close on this one, but Tulane Blacktop barely pulled ahead. If this was a race, it actually won. It won the nihilistic race, and it is now in the canon. You know how I feel about this, but so it goes.
All right, you guys, it's up to you guys at home. So, you know what? One of these episodes where Amy and I disagree, it's always interesting to see which side you guys come down on. This week,
the
I think
side
Amy
of
and
justice.
I. Yeah, sometimes. This week, Amy and I think are going to agree on All About Eve. Let me explain what this motion picture is. You have a harder time with that. Right?
Is that I'm not fair? Very good at summaries.
Yeah. Okay, I'll summarize it. All About Eve is the classic 1950 movie. It is 1950. Yeah, it is 1950. About the New York theater scene, and specifically about Eve Harrington, a young ingenue who comes into the world of a whole bunch of established Broadway people. At first, it seems like Eve is just a fan and a woman who really cares about the theater. But as the movie goes on, we begin to realize that Eve has serious ambitions, that she is doing whatever it takes to meet. This is a film probably best known for the astonishing performance of Bette Davis as Margot Channing, the Broadway star who has just turned 40 and realizes that her career is as good as over. It's a Joseph Mankiewicz film, which means that it is full of sharp and witty dialogue, and I think also has probably some of the best writing for women in a movie maybe ever.
Yeah, this is a movie for women with huge male parts, but also tons of great male actors in this film.
It's for women with huge male parts.
Wait, what does that even
mean?
That
is very much of the zeitgeist right now.
I did just see Magic Mike yesterday. What I said made no sense. Let me say something like, this is not even a movie for women. I want to take back everything I just said, because I think we're so trained to thinking that a movie with huge female roles like this is a woman's movie.
Well, the poster tagline says, it's all about women. And they're men.
Exactly. You guys, you men get a part in this. Now, All About Eve is fantastic. It's one of my favorite films, and it's actually based on a true story. There was a young actress named Elizabeth Bernier who in the early 30s had an assistant who she let move into her house and then realized that the assistant was trying to ruin her life. And she won't even actually tell people who the assistant was. She refers to her simply as the terrible girl. But Elizabeth Bernier would go around the New York theater scene just bitching about this woman who had tried to sabotage her career. And one of the people she bitched about it to was a woman named Mary Orr, who decided to turn this into a short story called The Wisdom of Eve. And that is the thing that Joseph L. Mankiewicz picked up for this film and wanted his favorite actress of the time, Claudette Colbert, to star. Have you seen any Claudette Colbert movies?
I've seen a couple. I'm not super-duper familiar with Claudette Colbert, to be very honest. It's a terrible truth.
There's a lot of actresses in the world. Claudette Colbert, you most know her from It Happened One Night. She's that wonderful big-eyed actress who went head-to-head with Clark Gable. She's terrifically funny, very posh, had a tendency to play like very slim-hipped modern debutantes. And she would have brought a really different edge to All About Eve. You know, her All About Eve was more glamorous, was more sophisticated, was a slightly more posh. Claudette Colbert hurt her back and so couldn't do All About Eve. And Joseph Mankiewicz ran through a bunch of actors, ended up putting in Bette Davis, whose career was on a slight nosedive, although that is Bette Davis's career. She acted forever until way, 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 way past. She might have retired if she didn't want to do some terrible movies in the very end of her life. But God bless her, because I think all of her movies are amazing. Put Bette Davis in the role. And it was a role that she really felt, because she was worried about her role as an actress in this moment. Bette Davis, for people who haven't become obsessed with her. I at one point had a Bette Davis light plate switch cover in my bedroom where it was just Bette Davis lounging around in like this silk dress, and I would have to like flick a light switch right by her head every time I wanted to turn the lights on and off. She was one of the toughest actresses of the 1930s. She was a scrapper. She'd go head-to-head with Warner Brothers fighting for the right to pick the roles she wanted. She felt like she got shoved into a lot of roles she hated because she just caused problems all the time. She was big and loud. She was not too far off from the character of Margot Channing that we see in All About Eve. They become kind of melded in our heads. But yet, she's an actress who found enough good roles that she was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. She was one of the absolute greats. And one of my absolute favorite terrible movies of hers, if people haven't seen it, is Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Have you seen that movie?
I don't like using the word terrible for that movie. I think it's the wrong word. The Room is terrible.
You're right.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane is unique and a little over the top. And it's a camp classic, much as All About Eve is a camp classic. Yeah, I think terrible is the wrong word. I use that word only for truly bad movies.
No, you're absolutely right, because now I regret using the word terrible, because this is a movie I've seen probably 11 times and loved to pieces. Masterful camp.
This is – you know what? So All About Eve, you know, I think we're both going to vote yes. And if the listeners agree, this will be the bitchiest movie that has ever made it into the canon. I mean, this is a bitchy movie.
Are you just saying that because it's women?
No, I'm saying that because they – bitch at each other, which I think is one of the reasons why this has become a gay camp classic. Betty Davis, anything Betty Davis does is gonna sort of hit that a little bit. But it is just there is such excellent withering wit all throughout this movie.
I mean, even beginning in the opening monologue.
Yeah, even the opening monologue, as the critic just really beautifully tears every character down to size. It is just one of these. Nobody makes movies where the dialogue is like this anymore. And people they sort of fight back against it. Like, well, this isn't naturalistic. Well, I don't want naturalistic dialogue. I want great dialogue. And This is a movie full of great dialogue.
Yeah, this is the snappiest dialogue in almost any film. I mean, this is a film where. This character, Bill Simpson, who's playing Betty Davis's much younger boyfriend, he's 8 years younger than her and he's a theater director, begs her, like, have you no human consideration? And she just fires back, show me a human and I might have.
Yeah, it's just full of really great. And it has, I think, probably one of Betty Davis's signature lines, which is, I think it's fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy night, which is a great line. And it is the beginning of a great scene of a party that just really goes fucking downhill. In a pretty profound
martini way.
What's really neat about All About Eve is that, you know, not only is it sort of – so it has this sort of camp classic thing, even though it's not campy in the way that a Rocky Horror Picture Show is. It's just campy in the way that it's a little bit heightened. It's these old grand dames who are just sort of like, you know, sort of like verbally catfighting, and it's sort of a lot of nastiness, a lot of arguing, a lot of really elevated arguing. But on top of that, All About Eve is like one murder away from being a horror movie. It really is. Eve Harrington just needs to knock off one person, and we are in straight up horror movie territory, because she is right on that like sociopathic edge.
Well, actually, rewatching this recently, I thought, oh, Rosamund Pike had to have studied this movie, had to have studied Eve in order to play her character in Gone Girl.
It really is. It's sort of that whole phony, creating a phony past, being a totally phony person. And then the second that it's pulled away, Anne Baxter just becomes cold as fucking ice. When Addington, the critic, confronts her with her true past, it is just – she just goes right from, oh, I have no idea what you mean, sir, to, and I'll do it all again. It is really incredible. It's pretty great.
Exactly. And there's so much work in just even the way she does her voice. You know, her voice and Rosamund Pike's are really similar in that they just have this super smoothing, really modulated, kind of unearthly way of talking that just sounds so plastic. And when you watch the movie knowing she's a faker, you just hear the fakeness and you want to like yell at people like, why don't you get this? But what one of the things Joseph L. Mankiewicz does in this film that I think is so smart is, you know, have this portrait of like an artificial woman who's super, super composed. But then he gives us moments where we get to see her and we get to see Betty Davis's Margot Channing when they're alone. And I think we don't see characters alone enough in movies, because we learn a lot about characters mainly in ways like their dialogue, what they say to people. But there's something that you get when you see a character by themselves, even if it's just for 30 seconds, when you see a glimpse of really who they are. And so you have moments like that here. You have moments where all of a sudden Eve thinks nobody is watching and her face just kind of changes, not in that monster movie way of snarling or like walking around with her shoulders all hunched up, looking like a horrible monster, but more just, you know, taking a big sigh or looking sort of greedy. And you get to see her alone.
Yeah, it's really interesting that for probably the first three quarters of the movie, we in the opening scene, which is sort of Eve Harrington getting an award for her excellence on Broadway, we barely even see Eve Harrington. And as the movie goes on for the first three quarters, we are never seeing the movie from her POV. Ever. She's always coming into other people's scenes. People are always talking about her. She's kind of like Poochie. If Poochie is not in a scene, people must be asking, where is Poochie right now?
Yeah, which is striking because the movie does shift perspective several times.
Yeah, and a couple times. And he does that with a really elegant voiceover. You know, the first thing you're going to learn in screenwriting class is don't do voiceover. And Mankiewicz is like, fuck you. Here's a lot of really great voiceover. Yeah. That really is just – it's used perfectly and it is smooth and it's funny and it perfectly puts you into the new POV. We don't get Eve's POV until the very end. And again, it's similar. Gone Girl is a really good example because at the end when we finally get Eve's POV, it's when she's being found out. And even though we know that she's bad at this point, we sort of can't help but feel like – tense that she's being found out. Like, what's going to happen? Is she going to be able to? Even though she's awful, she doesn't murder anybody. Again, this is a murder. This is a murder shy of being a real thriller. But she's a bad person. You mentioned that you see her face change, and it's not like a snarling monster, but she is a monster, but in that really real world way. Like everybody knows an Eve Harrington, somebody who is, you know, really sweet and nice and doing everything they can to undermine you behind your back and take your place.
That's me to you.
Yeah, but you're not sweet and nice.
No.
So.
I'm just a very bad Eve Harrington.
Yeah, and you don't have that wit either. You don't have that Mankiewicz
wit. Eve Harrington's not funny. She doesn't tell a single joke this whole time.
That is true. That is true. She is.
So see, I can be Eve Harrington.
You can. Well, no, you can't because Eve Harrington barely even drinks when there's a scene where Margot's having a little bit of a breakdown about Eve, and her boyfriend goes to get her a drink and sees Eve and says, "Eve, what would you like to have?" And Betty Davis says, "A milkshake," which I love. I love. It's such a bitchy way. It's such a bitchy thing. It's so good. So. Speaking of this movie as sort of a gay touchstone, there are two characters who have been read as being coded gay in this movie. Eve Harrington is one of them. Eve Harrington has been read very often as being coded gay. And the other is the critic, Addington, who is notable for a couple of reasons in this movie, one of which is that he introduces the world to Marilyn Monroe.
He does. This was Marilyn Monroe's – one of her very first tiny, tiny parts – Joseph Mankiewicz didn't want her in the film. He didn't think she was good enough. He thought that she couldn't get the comedy. And Marilyn Monroe was kind of a nobody when she shows up in this. And this isn't even a movie that made her a star.
Right.
She just appeared. It's just a wonderful coincidence that she's in this. But she plays a young actress named Miss Caswell who is brought in by the critic and sort of set loose on the men at the party to try to flirt with the producers and get into a role. And she has that great line where she says, "Why do they all look like unhappy rabbits?"
And he says, "Go make him happy."
And then she puts on her fake smile. And right. We get to see that Marilyn Monroe fake, bright, sexy smile actually take place on a Marilyn Monroe-like figure, which is amazing. And she's an interesting contrast, her character, to Eve Harrington.
Right.
Because you have two young actresses trying to make it in New York, one of them doing it the kind of way we're used to by wearing low-cut dresses and charming every man in the room. There's that lovely scene where she gets the producer Max Fabian to get her a drink. And she just kind of grabs it from his hand really gently and smiles and has him eating out of her hand. And then there's Eve Harrington, who does it the very hard, long way of just scheming and being absolutely manipulative.
And only one of them is a success. You know, the Monroe character bombs out an audition and Addington tells her it's time to go into TV. And she says, "Are there auditions in TV?" And he says, "Darling, television is nothing but auditions," which I love. It's, again, this is like such a really great, bitchy way of cutting something down.
It's true, but you know what's so interesting about that? And I never thought about it till I just said this out loud, is that you have one strategy in which the young actress is appealing only to the men, and then you have the other strategy where the young actress is appealing to women.
Well,
this movie kind of says that women are the ones that run the show.
Well, this is part of the gay reading of the movie, which is that Eve's relationship with Betty Davis is coded, even though the character is not necessarily sexually involved, it's coded as a domestic same-sex union, especially when the boyfriend goes out of town to work in Hollywood for a month. And then later on, we see that Eve Harrington's a character who only uses her sexuality to get ahead, who appears to have no actual innate sexuality. The only time we ever see her with anybody where there's a potential that there's like – actual softness or caring is the scene where she is trying to get the boyfriend over to her boarding house, and her roommate is very, very chummy with her in a way that in 1950 America people maybe would have read in the time of the production code as meaning something. And it's hard. It's hard to parse this.
Yeah, I don't know if I actually buy that. Yeah, I would buy that Eve is like asexual, but Eve is also trying to pick up every man in the film, and not necessarily because she really is lusting after them, but because she thinks they'd be good
for her
career.
They're all moves, right? They're all moves. Yeah, there's not a single moment where she cares about a single person, although she maybe does she care about Bette Davis. It's sort of – she really does seem to actually give a shit and look up to this character. She really cares about Margot.
I think
she – but she also wants to destroy Margot.
Yeah, she just wants to be Margot, but I don't think she wants to sleep with Margot.
Addison DeWitt, the critic, seems to be a little bit more – clear-cut gay. His final thing where he gets into a room and tells Eve, I know your secrets and now you belong to me, is the most desexualized way of doing that. It feels very clearly like a beard. And him hanging out with even Marilyn Monroe's character, at first you're like, you go get yours. And then as you watch it, he's sending her off to go hit on other dudes. And you're like, oh, this is an intriguing relationship right here.
Yeah, I mean, they're both just into power.
Right.
Yeah, which makes me wonder, I watch this character and I always watch this and I think, why is a critic hanging out so much with actors, like and producers? To me, that's one of my nightmares. Like, you get to know people.
I've been at parties with you with actors and producers and directors.
Yeah, but
like
I don't,
in people's apartments, like at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Well, yeah, but I never review their stuff. Because I feel like once you do that, you can't review stuff. But Addison is just like, oh, I'll go to Margot's house, I'll drink all her booze, and then I'll write the nastiest stuff about
her.
Yeah,
Addison's like
paper.
A real fucking hero to me, by the way. That is like – that is some real hot shit. I like that a lot. Like, he fucking destroys Margot. She's weeping. He breaks Bette Davis with just the power of his pen after he spent all night drinking at her house. Man, that is – yeah, I don't have that. I don't have that ability.
Yeah. Actually, I think you probably do.
Yeah. I actually got a – I know there's a recent motion picture that came out that I won't name where I do believe that the filmmaker was really bothered by my continued harping on how bad the movie was. And I feel bad about it.
Did he reach out to you?
The studio did.
Wow. On his behalf? Like his
was
mom?
It was not specified. I've had studios reach out to me on the behalf of filmmakers in the past and be like, can you stop being so mean?
I think Twitter has made this whole world between directors like we directors well, that is, and see, critics as close as this, I suppose.
That
but
is
we're
because,
not even getting booze out of
because
it.
Because you see people just bullshitting with filmmakers, film critics bullshitting with filmmakers all day long, trading jokes and puns. It isn't that different, you know?
No, and I've heard horror stories too of like a director who DM'd a critic to be like, why didn't you like my movie? I thought we were friends.
Yeah. It's tough.
It's tough.
It's tough. That's why Addison's a hero, because he just does what he's got to do. He's committed to the art form.
You know, he's interesting because even just last year, we had so many critics in movies. You had the critic in Birdman. You had what other critics? I felt like there were so many critics in movies last year. Now I just blanked on them.
I mean, there's a couple of critics you can think of in movies. You know,
you got like the critic in Ratatouille. Oh, yeah, Ratatouille
is another
one. Chef was one.
But you know, this is what's really interesting. Very often is that critics are being written from the POV of the filmmaker, mm-hmm. So they're often negative characters. They're often hateful characters. They're all people who don't get it. People who are there to destroy. Addison's a really interesting character because he is there to destroy, and he is a destructive force in a lot of ways. But he's also Mankiewicz has enough of a sarcastic, corrosive view of the world of entertainment that he actually sides with the critic in a pretty profound way a lot of the time. It's no mistake that the movie opens with Addison's POV.
Yeah, and with Addison being such a snob, he refers to the Pulitzer as a questionable honor.
And he talks about the award that the film people get together and give each other every year. There's a lot of that. And on some level, I think Mankiewicz has enough of a cynical eye towards the world of entertainment that he's not – every character and every – every job takes a hit. There's a really great scene in here where the quote is, when did the piano start thinking it wrote the concerto?
Right.
About how actors maybe go a little bit above and beyond in taking ownership of the work. So Mankiewicz allows Addison to be an important part of the world of entertainment. It's maybe actually one of the better examples of a critic in in a movie ever.
I mean, I think that says a lot about the examples of critics we get. But at least if you're going to compare him to the character, to the theater critic in Birdman, the theater critic in Birdman exists only to drink in a bar and then say she wants to destroy everything. Addison at least feels like he cares about the theater.
Yeah, Addison definitely has a sense. That's one of the things he likes about Eve, is that Eve cares about the theater. Is that Eve is as awful as she is and as conniving and as deceptive as she is, she honestly comes from a place of giving a shit about the theater, which maybe is more than you can say for other people in this movie. Even Margot, who really gives a shit about Margot, does she actually give a shit about the theater? She certainly gives a shit about her and her performance and people loving her. She doesn't miss a show, not because she cares about the show, we were told, but because she cares about people seeing Margot up on stage.
It's true, but then you get the sense that Margot has just been a star since she was four, like Addison says in that narrative opening where she runs it into Midsummer Night's Dream naked and nobody's expecting it, and that she's been a star ever since. I feel like she cares about the theater because she doesn't – it's like a frog caring about the water.
She doesn't know anything else. We'll take a quick break right now, and we will come back and talk more about the despicable and bitchy characters of All About Eve.
All right, so we are back. We are talking about All About Eve, one of my favorite movies, a movie that I hope everybody is seeing. You can watch it right now on Netflix, streaming for free. Do that. So I want to talk about a couple of things about this film. I want to talk about you were referring right before we took the break about that opening where Addison DeWitt so drolly says refers to the that award that the film people give each other out in Hollywood. All About Eve was the first time where two actresses from the same film were pitted against each other in an award category. Anne Baxter and Bette Davis were pitted against each other for Best Actress.
Wasn't there Best Supporting Actress? But wasn't there like – weren't women in every acting category for this picture?
Yeah, this got four acting awards – or four acting nominations for the women in it, which I think is a record for one film and the number of female performances in that film. All About Eve actually set a record as well for Oscar nominations. It got 14, which
Titanic.
I think it held until Titanic.
Titanic, yeah.
I love Titanic. Are we going to do a Titanic episode?
I mean, eventually someday.
I'm pretty excited about it. But yeah, this actually started
Noah wanted
a controversy.
To come fight you about Titanic. That was what he wanted to do.
I wasn't going to let him.
And I was like, no, let's stay on brand, Noah. Let's stay on the Noah Segan brand.
I mean, I asked him if he was going to come on and like say that he liked Titanic. And when he said he was going to hate it, I thought it would ruin our friendship forever. And, you know, as a critic, I got to stay friends with actors. But yeah, this actually has caused a controversy in the way that the Academy Award counted votes for actors' categories. Because what happened is this was such a great year for female performances. Not only did you have Bette Davis and Anne Baxter going head-to-head in the category, this was also the same year that Gloria Swanson was nominated for Sunset Boulevard. So everyone was like, oh, man, it's going to be one of the three of them. One of the three of them is going to take it. And then they all split the votes between each other. And so this actress, Judy Holliday, won for Born Yesterday. And I just love the idea of being at that Oscar ceremony and everybody turning around and staring at Judy and her just being like, I'm so sorry.
She probably didn't even write a speech.
She probably didn't even – she was probably wearing like a pantsuit. She probably didn't care.
It's funny you mentioned Sunset Boulevard because I now sort of wish that we had pitted this against Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, my God. That
because
made me cry.
I like both the – I like this movie a lot. I think I like Sunset Boulevard better.
Really?
Yeah.
I like this better.
I like Sunset Boulevard is they're both mean. These are both mean movies. I like mean movies. But Sunset Boulevard is like real mean. And Sunset Boulevard has the distinction of being one of the few films ever told from the POV of a corpse.
Yeah, and it actually has a murder. So you like that.
It has a murder in it. Speaking of corpses, just a really quick aside. George Sanders, who plays Addison DeWitt, the critic, he killed himself. And he left one of the most baller suicide notes anybody ever
left. What did they say?
Left. He took five bottles of Nembutal, and they didn't find him for 2 days after he killed himself near Barcelona. And his suicide – this is really
– wow.
This is a really good suicide note. Dear world, I am leaving because I am bored. I feel I have lived long enough. I am leaving you with your worries in this sweet cesspool. Good luck.
Holy shit. Oh, my God.
That is a great suicide note.
Wait, he used to be married to Zsa Zsa Gabor.
He sure was.
And he goes out of the world like that?
Well, you can blame him.
My God. Wow.
What a great suicide. That is like – that should be like on T-shirts. Good luck. That's a great way to end your suicide note.
I feel like that's what I should give you for your birthday, assuming I don't forget. Well, actually, he's not even the only suicide in this movie. There's a second one.
Who else killed themselves?
The very last face we see, the young actress who arrives to supplant Eve at the very last scene. She too was like a young teenage actress, gets this as her first real role in Hollywood, desperate to do some great work, and ends up having All About Eve be the only film she did that people really, really cared about. And wound up killing herself as well about a decade later, because she felt like she never had the career she wanted either.
Yeah, she killed herself after marrying a sportscaster. So her life had really hit rock bottom. She had married a sportscaster.
They have really good voices.
But you know, the thing is that this is some real grim, morbid stuff, but that really feels like a part of these kinds of movies. These are grim, morbid movies.
These are characters who take making art they're proud of very seriously.
But they're also very dark. It is interesting. This came out the same year as Sunset Boulevard. I mean, both films about fading actresses.
Imagine the think pieces.
Jesus Christ. The hot takes alone would burn us all. Gloria Swanson is pretty amazing. It's interesting because All About Eve is pretty broad a lot of the time. It definitely has the broadness of a stage play, but Sunset Boulevard, Swanson really, really is projecting it out there. I mean, that movie is super fucking dark. I mean, All About Eve's dark, and then it has that beautiful twisty dark ending where we realize that Eve has found a new Eve who's going to do to her what she did to Margot. She only gets a year. Margot had a lot more time.
Yeah, that's what I like about it, is that you see fame speeding up. Is that, you know, Margot gets a full career, and now younger and younger actresses are just going to be churning it out faster and faster.
There's two really great shots at the end of this movie, both in the same scene. It's when Eve comes back to her hotel room, and Phoebe's sleeping in the chair, and Eve doesn't realize she's there, and she's walking around the room, and she's standing in front of the mirror, and Mankiewicz frames in such a way that we see Phoebe sitting there, but Eve is doing something and doesn't notice her. And it's a very long time that we see Phoebe sitting there, and we are just waiting for Eve to notice, and it's really terrific tension. It's excellent tension.
It is, and you know what's interesting now that I think about it? What Eve is doing is she's fixing herself a drink. Mm-hmm. And I think it is the first time we get to see her really, really drink in the film, and it's because she's alone and doesn't have to worry about keeping up the pretense.
Of being the innocent girl with the dead war hero husband. But then the shot later on, the very, very last shot of the movie, which is Phoebe putting on Eve's dress and standing in the mirror with the award, and then there's just a thousand fractal images of her, and the music comes up, and it's triumphant, but it's dark. It's really astonishing. There's a couple of things. There's another great bit where they felt really modern in this movie and it's during the award ceremony. As Eve is being handed the award, the film pauses.
Yeah,
and Addison just keeps talking over it. And it's really neat. It's a little bit meta. It's very much sort of like he is saying, like, let's stop and look at this for a second. I that feels very modern to me.
It is. And what's so weird, I never noticed this until last night, which is probably the seventh time I've watched this movie. When he freeze frames it, what's right behind Eve on the wall is a gun.
Really?
Yeah.
That is not an accident.
Although it's pointing at her. But
that makes sense considering what happens to her later on that night. I mean, that is sort of – That is the subtle thing saying Eve, it has turned – the worm has turned. It is your turn now to get taken down.
See, here's why I think I like this better than Sunset Boulevard. Sunset Boulevard is, to me, more like a Greek tragedy. Even what they do with Gloria Swanson, she's larger than life. She's full of pathos. You feel a sad for her, but she's also shot in kind of ghastly ways.
Oh, no, she's kind of a monster.
Exactly.
And she lives in this ridiculous – decaying mansion that is, like, even by, like, 1920 standards is probably kind of creepy and weird.
It basically looks like no one has cleaned it since the last party in 1927,
right,
where maybe Fatty Arbuckle killed someone. But
Fatty Arbuckle never killed anybody.
That is one of the great slanders
in Hollywood history.
It's true. I take it back. But Bette Davis here and Margot Channing, they don't do that to her character. And, in fact, what I think is so great about the Margot Channing character is that she does what Bette Davis has nailed in so many fantastic movies. If you like this movie, go back and watch things like Jezebel, Mr. Skeffington, because Bette Davis has this way of playing these large, gigantic, funny, confident, cruel women who are also at the same time really vulnerable. And you don't get to see vulnerability a lot in these, like, loud, kind of ball-busting, larger-than-life characters. But Margot Channing never lets you forget that part of why she's lashing out is because she's so nervous about her place in the world.
Right.
And there's such a sadness and a vulnerability to that character that I think makes this a really rich film and doesn't treat that character as harsh as it does Gloria Swanson.
No, Margot Channing definitely. And it's really interesting because very early on, and maybe this is just a function of having seen this movie before. I'm curious for somebody who has seen – I don't remember seeing this movie. This is one of those ones I don't remember seeing for the first time. I've seen it on TV a lot. I've seen it a bunch of times. But I wonder if seeing the first time Margot's deep paranoia about Eve that comes to the surface very early in the picture, watching it with the knowledge of what the story is one of those things where that makes her very sympathetic to me because everybody thinks that she's crazy, but she's not. She's totally right. I am curious, like, as what a first timer takes away from that, like that deep paranoia. I think the movie sets it up in such a way that you understand that Eve is not all that she appears to be. But yeah, that is neat that it's sort of Mankiewicz gives us the opportunity to sort of see this character have multiple layers. She's not just sort of a snotty, you know, egotistical theater lady. She's a woman who's unsure of herself, who's unsure of her place in the world, who has found herself staring into the future that she doesn't know where her place is in it, and also isn't having a hard time reconciling herself with her own feelings of inner strength versus what society demands of her as a woman, which is to be married and have a man at her side. And she
which
has this whole speech.
She's put off until she's 40, which is a huge deal.
Back then, it's a big deal, right? It's still a big deal today.
Yeah.
By the way, I say to my aging co-host.
Screw you. You know I've been proposed to and said no.
So I'm sure Margot has as well.
That's true. Margot, I feel you. But no, the speech you're talking about, that's the one, right, where she is sitting and drinking champagne with her friends and she just goes, funny business, a woman's career, the things you drop on your way up the ladder so you can move faster, you forget you'll need them when you go back to being a woman.
It's a really great bit. And it's one of those bits where you're like, man, I feel like this is like, are there any men writing like this for women today? Like there's such a, you know, I'm not a woman, but I listen to that and that feels honest and true to me. And that feels honest and true about both ambition and femininity.
Right.
And about
it doesn't feel like Scarlett Johansson and the Avengers being like, I can't have a baby.
Totally different.
It
and
feels
I think
real.
You're really unfair. It feels less like Bryce Dallas, Jessica Chastain in Jurassic World saying, I hate kids. Now I like kids.
Well, I felt that character too. I don't really enjoy most kids. No, that's not true. I like most kids when I meet them. I just don't like them in the abstract or on airplanes.
It's interesting. That's actually really interesting. And I don't want to, you know, when this – I guess the Jurassic World is still in the air when this podcast is going to air. What a different look at a woman who is career-driven between Margot Channing and Jurassic World, where in Jurassic World the arc is this is a woman who's career-driven, who doesn't have a family, who has made that choice. And over the course of the movie has characters telling her she's wrong. Literally, Judy Greer tells her, you are wrong. You have to have children and you won't understand life until you've had children versus Margot Channing, who is a character who has made the decision not to have a family or children, who is career driven and who is only plagued by her own self-doubts. That's it. Nobody else says to her, you're wrong or you've done wrong. It's just her own self-doubts. That feels like a more rounded, real character thing as opposed to having the movie come out and say, how dare you care about your career more than you care about having a family. And it's weird that All About Eve is 60 years old and it feels more progressive in the way that it deals with a career woman than Jurassic World, which just came out 2 weeks ago.
I hear you, but it's interesting because I actually didn't even read that Judy Greer scene the same way. Maybe it's just what my own perspective to it, but I was just thinking, oh, well, her sister's annoying. I wasn't thinking the movie is right. I was thinking that'd be annoying to have that sister telling me what to do.
The movie is 100% coming out on the side of the sister for a couple of reasons. One is that, I mean, it has her say that and then it has the whole – it's echoing that arc of Alan Grant and the kids in the first Jurassic Park, except that in the first Jurassic Park, the movie never says, how dare you have a career but not kids. But also the movie is all about Bryce Dallas, Jessica Chastain moving away from being a cold businesswoman to being rescued by the – beefy man. And those two characters walking off into the white light at the end of the movie lets you understand that she has left behind the world of business and has instead moved on to the world of love. And
I can see how you could see that, but I could also see how the next day she shows up back to work and she's like, cool, I'm still on birth control.
No, the next day it's Son of Kong where they show up and they arrest her for tremendous malfeasance and she spends the rest of her life in jail. But even in that movie, it's really interesting. It's just so fascinating. saying, I really don't like that movie. And so it, and it's like, it's even like, there's a scene in Jurassic World where she beats a raptor, no, a pteranodon, who is that is killing Chris Pratt. She beats it to death, right? And then they all run away, and they're with these two kids, these two annoying kids. And then they get into a Jeep. And when they get into the Jeep, everything's quiet for a second. And the kids say, wherever we go, we want to stay with you. And she goes, okay, I won't leave your side. And they go, no, we're talking about him. And it's like, what the fuck? They haven't seen him do anything cool. They just saw her kill a fucking dinosaur. And that is the movie specifically saying, Bryce Dallas, Jessica Howard Chastain, whatever happens, you will always be less cool than the man. And again, so this movie from 1950 feels radically more progressive than a movie from 2015.
This is so funny. I just thought the kids were jerks too.
Everybody in the movie is a jerk. I mean, yeah. That is not the case. But it's a Jurassic Park movie. On some level, the kids are our eyes into the world, and so we accept what they are doing. And nobody replies, well, fuck you, I just killed a dinosaur. You know, that would have been like the proper reply.
That would actually be the best reply for anything. Well, and actually, I'll give you this. In Jurassic World, you know, of course, she's running around in these heels, which I have some sympathy for the movie for having her be in those heels because she just came from work and we're really not in a place where women
Why doesn't she have sneakers in the car?
When does she get to really?
Because she works on a gigantic – she works on a tropical island. Why wouldn't she have sneakers in her car? If she has to get out of the car and go look at an exhibit, she would change into her sneakers. That just makes like basic sense.
They're walking around on the Mito platforms. But this is what I was going to get to. She's wearing high heels in this movie running around from dinosaurs. Betty Davis has this scene where she's wandering around a gigantic cocktail party in her house wearing the most beautiful evening gown and it has pockets. Then that's my dream.
I just think it's crazy that we're living in a world where old movies are more progressive than new movies. I mean, like, and that this is a great movie that did really well, and we don't. This is not a movie that has created like a tremendous, you know, canon of female-oriented great pictures, which is crazy to me because it is harder to find movies to feature on this show that are female-driven. It's harder to do.
It is, and I feel like this is a movie everybody would really like. You know, this is – what I object is when you have stuff like people saying movies with female characters are just made for female audiences. It reminds me – not to bring up Dope for like the millionth time, but I'm bringing up Dope again. I was listening to this interview with the director of Dope this week, and he said that every time a movie starring a black cast comes out, people say, oh, great, this is black filmmaking, or what is this going to do for black audiences? And he was like, what if every time Paul Thomas Anderson made a movie, you had to say, what does this say for white people?
Yeah, but that's what it is, though. Paul Thomas Anderson makes movies for white people. I mean, like, I love Paul Thomas Anderson movies. I up and down, but Paul PTA makes white people movies.
He does, but we don't talk about it in those terms.
Funnily enough, Dope is a white person movie. So
Dope is not a white person.
It's 100% a white person
Dope
movie.
Is not
it
a white
is a
person
movie,
movie
for white people, first and foremost. This is a really great
– Just because white people like this movie doesn't make it's like a white person movie.
There's a lot of things that make it a white person. It's about fucking Bitcoin.
Wait, like that is black like the teenagers whitest... can't use Bitcoin?
First of all, nobody uses Bitcoin. Second of all, it's just white nerds that use Bitcoin. Like, come on. Who's Bitcoin? Give me a break. Like, listen, I believe lots of kids from Inglewood right now are using Bitcoin. Nobody's using Bitcoin, period. And then the people who are using
– fictitious money, they can use it wherever
people
they want
People who are
to.
Using Bitcoin are like the most hardcore dweebs and it's just like white hackers. That's it.
A white hacker who teaches them to use Bitcoin.
That fucking guy that just went away to prison for his whole life because of Silk Road, that's who uses Bitcoin.
Yeah. That's the guy who shows them how to use Bitcoin.
He's a white kid.
Yeah.
Well, that kid though, that's a whole different – that's a whole different series of
Listen,
horrifying
By the time
moments.
This podcast comes out, hopefully
Dope will
people
be gone.
Will finally have a chance to see Dope and know that for months
Dope
been
will have
wrong
come
this.
And gone.
You've been super wrong on this.
By then. All right. And what we're going to do right now is take one last quick break. And when we come back, Amy and I will tell you exactly why we believe you should be voting yes to put All About Eve into the canon. All right. So we are back. So for Amy and I think this is – For both of us, a big yes vote. And I guess this is now the portion where we're going to try to sort of really boil it down for you guys to explain why you should be voting yes. And hopefully you've seen the movie. And I feel like if you've seen the movie, that this is not even a question. You're like, oh, this is just a great movie. And that alone, I think, earns it canon status. But more than that, I think it's the quality of the performances in this picture. Betty Davis especially gives a scorcher picture of a performance in this movie, a performance that has real dynamic range that goes from really nasty, bitchy stuff to totally vulnerable, open, and deeply wounded. You know, George Sanders, his Addison DeWitt, I think, is one of the great critic characters in the history of cinema. We don't get a lot of great critics in movies. But more than that, I think this is a great film about entertainment, about ambition, about the collision of these worlds that I think speaks a lot of truth. And I think that even if you aren't in entertainment, I think the stuff that it says about ambition and about careers and about people who give their career, their all their attention and leave their personal life behind, I think this stuff all resonates to this day no matter what. And also I think, you know, something Amy said before, this is a really great movie that is about women that is not a women's film. This is a movie that is just a great film. This isn't a kind of movie where you have to walk in and happen to have a lot of estrogen going through your body to really get it. This is just a great movie that happens to be a film where the leads are women. And I think that's really exciting and really fun and definitely earns it a place in the canon.
Exactly. I mean, the Oscars every year have this pattern of taking any film that refers to something about the business and just rewarding it with tons of praise. We see this with The Artist, Shakespeare in Love, Birdman. This is a film that's actually set in the entertainment world that has real points of view, that has things it's saying about who these people are, and that each of these characters have a real role to play. And they're not just these like flat archetypes. They're not just these stereotypes that make the business look loud and weird and crazy. These are real people who really care about each other, coming together, and also having the story that we can all just build from and draw these different pieces to. This is a movie that frames its world so perfectly that even when the own characters are talking about their own lives, they're referring to it in these theatrical terms. You know, they're saying like, oh, well, here's the scene where we do this. And all right, now you can like put the curtain down. You know, everything they even talk about in their own emotions comes through this worldview. You know, it's seamless. I love the dialogue in this. I love all the tiny details. I love just throwaway bits where you see Betty Davis living in her new life of luxury by just leaning back and eating fried chicken. I mean, it just the smile on her face, like she's never been happier in her life. You know, there are so many lines from this film that have just become a part of the canon, and they should. I kind of want every film in this to be, every line in this to just be things we say. I want to quote this movie all the time. I hope that a lot of our listeners are already fairly familiar with Betty Davis. If not, I hope that this is a film that hooks people on her and makes people go back and like look at the work she did. You know, because All About Eve came out of a tail period of several decades where the movies that made money were the movies that starred women.
Right.
And where it was the actresses who carried the day. And somehow we stopped trusting in that, which makes no sense to me. But this movie just solidifies it. You have these great characters and they'll pull in everybody. I think one of the smallest, most inconsequential reasons to put this in the canon is just that it introduces Marilyn Monroe. And the idea that this introduces Marilyn Monroe, and that's not even what makes this film important at all, it just kind of validates everything that's so fantastic about it.
It's kind of neat seeing Marilyn Monroe and Betty Davis share a scene. Where Betty Davis is kind of a bitch to Marilyn Monroe, and that feels correct. That feels right. That feels sort of like
exactly.
That feels sort of like the old guard meeting the next generation and being dismissive.
Exactly. I just love the thought that Joseph L. Mankiewicz put in this film. You know, when you can watch a film and you can see how smart the director was and how he thought of every little moment, just even down to the moment where Betty Davis sees her enemy Addison DeWitt at a restaurant, and when he lifts his glass to her, she just picks up a celery stick and then bites it. I mean, there's not a second of this that hasn't been perfectly thought out. And you can really see it when you see a film that does that right.
You know, I think that if we put this in the canon, if I'm totally correct, this will be the first Mankiewicz movie, and the Mankiewicz family looms large in the history of golden era Hollywood. I mean, Joseph's brother, Herman, wrote Citizen Kane, for God's sake.
And Ben Mankiewicz, who is what, their nephew, their great-nephew?
Something like that.
Yeah, he's on Turner Classic Movies right now.
I'm not sure that really counts as looming large. I really like Ben. I like Ben. But, you know, this guy wrote Citizen Kane. This guy's on Turner Classics Movies. not exactly the same thing. You know what I mean? I love my man Ben Mankiewicz. I love that there's a continuity of the Mankiewicz clan throughout history.
Oh, my God. Is there going to be a Farachi clan?
God, no. I'm not having children. None that I'm aware of.
You should. You really should have children.
None that I'm aware of.
You really
of.
Should, though.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Judy Greer. Mm-hmm. You know, everything from Citizen Kane to Cleopatra, the movie that ended the golden age of Hollywood, that really sort of cleared the decks and allowed the Hollywood new wave, to fucking Superman, Richard Donner's Superman, one of the movies that is the earliest touchstones for the current wave of superhero movies that really dominate the world right now. The Mankiewicz family has had their fingers in all of these things. Just on that level alone, we need some Mankiewicz in the canon, and Joe Joseph's a good place to start, I feel like. I like Cleopatra, you know?
Yeah, Cleopatra gets a bad rap.
Yeah, it's just bloated, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, every time a film like that comes out, like Titanic, in the build-up, we're like, oh, that's going to be a disaster, and Cleopatra just never quite shook it off, whereas Titanic was like, ta-da, I'm amazing.
I'd like to do Cleopatra because I think that's a really interesting discussion sort of in terms of what belongs in the canon in terms of historical value, because Cleopatra is the movie that almost shut down Fox. The fact that there's a place right now known as Century City is because Fox had to sell off their entire fucking backlot just to stay solvent. So all of Century City used to be the Fox lot. So it's Century City because it's 20th Century Fox. That alone makes Cleopatra the movie that made the studio system fall to its fucking knees by costing so much and being not a disaster, but just never being able to be profitable enough. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. So for me, All About Eve is a hard yes, a strong yes, a great yes. Amy, I'm the same for you.
It couldn't be harder. It's as hard as my picks.
Oh, I don't like doing this show anymore. Okay. So it's up to you guys now. Go to wolfpop.com and find the forums and then go to the canon. And there in the forums, there will be an official voting thread for you to make your opinions known. Hopefully you guys will have a chance to watch this motion picture before you vote. There was, Tulane Blacktop, as you foresaw. I think we had really good engagement, by the way. Amy was very worried we were not going to have good engagement on Tulane Blacktop because it is hard to find.
Yeah.
There was good engagement, but a lot of people who hadn't seen it weighing in. So hopefully you will have seen this motion picture.
There's no excuse. It's on Netflix. Hit a button.
Like I guess they don't have Netflix as an excuse. If they're out of the country. Netflix is not available in every nation.
Oh, that's true.
And not every nation's Netflix has the same movies. So why don't you just stop being so fucking Americocentric for just a second?
You are the most Americocentric person on this podcast. We get so much hate mail from people being like, I'm in Australia and I'm not a convict.
No, everybody in Australia loved my joke about Australian high school. I was like, that's like the worst joke I've ever made in my life. And the Australians were like, that was pretty funny, which I guess is what happens when you come from that kind of background. Like you just have like a lowered. Some of my best friends are Australians. No, they're not.
All right. Well, speaking of the forums, next week's episode, we're going to pick a listener suggestion. Daniel Powers, we are taking your suggestion, and we're going to do Revenge of the Nerds versus Animal House.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Revenge of the Nerds is sort of a date rape versus statutory rape. That's the battle of these two movies. So I'm pretty excited to see how this all works.
From what I remember, you did not pick up on the Revenge of the Nerds rape implication until I got drunk and yelled at you about it. And
yeah, I feel like it might have
and took all the credit.
I feel like I might have come late to the Revenge of the Nerds rape thing because partially I hadn't seen Revenge of the Nerds in like forever and ever and ever. The way that it worked out when I rewatched that movie, we'll talk about it
next week.
But boy, that was horrifying. So Revenge of the Nerds versus Animal House. We'll have a toga party right here at the Canon next week. My name is Devin Faraci. You can find me on the internet at DevinCF on Twitter and birthmoviesdeath.com every single goddamn day.
And I'm Amy Nicholson. You can find me at the LA Weekly and at the Amy Nicholson. And as always, thanks for listening. Rate, tell your friends about us. We really appreciate it. And have a good weekend.
The show comes out on Mondays.
Oh, wait. Can I not say have a good weekend?
No, just we'll leave that in. Leave that in. Have a good week, everybody. Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.